Hi guys, I'm Greg Knox, and these are the Worst 8 Movies Ever, a collection of films that you definitely don't want to watch if you want to get laid tonight. I am joined by a very special guest today. I am joined by the managing director of the Triptych Gallery in Kiev, Ukraine. It's Miroslava Hartmand.
Well, thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure.
Awesome. Now, these are the Worst 8 Movies Ever. Now, you're the first non-male guest that I've had on the show. Maybe you have like a experience of a bad date movie that you've been exposed to, shall we say, maybe?
You know, I don't think I have a fun story to tell about myself, but I have the perfect bad date story to tell about a friend of mine, Alex Desadnikov, who is actually now a practicing psychoanalyst. And I think this was when I was like 13 or 14. I mean, he's considerably older than me. And he told me this story about how he took someone out to see 21 Grams when it just came out. So he went to watch that, you know, in the cinema. This must have been like, what, 2003, 4, something like that.
Right.
And obviously, you know, it's a very kind of heart-wrenching kind
literally.
Of drama. Literally, yes, a heart-wrenching drama. I mean, the title refers to this, you know, this idea that a human soul weighs 21 grams. So when somebody dies, they become 21 grams lighter. It's a pretty heavy-going film with Benicio del Toro and who else is in it?
It's Sean Penn.
That's right, Sean Penn.
He's very Sean Penn in 21
He's
Grams.
He's very Sean Penn in 21 Grams. And needless to say, he did not get laid that night.
No, I can't imagine why.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you for telling me that story. Right. So, for those who don't know, if you are not subscribed for whatever reason, you can do so on iTunes or on YouTube or on Spotify, wherever it is that you listen to your podcasts. And thank you very much. If you've enjoyed the three previous episodes that I've done, please let me know on Twitter at Worst 8 Movies. And if you've got any possible films that you think might qualify as a really fucking bad date movie, please let me know on Twitter at Worst 8 Movies, as I said. So the reason that I drug Miroslava onto the show today is to talk about a Ukrainian film, because you are British-Ukrainian, are you not?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I would say this is a Soviet film rather than a Ukrainian one. But yeah, it's by a director who subsequently took Ukrainian citizenship and who is a Ukrainian director, I would say.
Yeah, so the director in question is Kira Muratova. And the film that we are talking about today is called The Asthenic Syndrome. So Kira Muratova, for those of you who don't know, which I imagine will probably be a lot of people listening to this show, as Miro's already said, she's not a Ukrainian citizen per se. She was actually born in Romania, or what was Romania and is now Moldova.
Yeah. So the Kingdom of Romania. So before the communists took over, she was born then.
Mm-hmm. Those dastardly communists. so she's not really that well known in the West. Obviously, like the most well known Soviet director would be like Andrei Tarkovsky, and there were other Soviet directors that came along which were less well known. Now, she had quite a long career. Believe it started in the 50s or the 60s.
So she started making films in the early 60s with her first husband, Alexander Muratov. That's where her surname comes from. And she went to film school in the 50s. So she actually went to the Gerasimov Institute of Cinematography, which is, you know, very famous because you mentioned Tarkovsky. She actually studied with Tarkovsky, with Alexander Sakurov. This is also somewhere where Parajanov went, and of course, Eisenstein as well. Sergei Eisenstein, who also went there. So she actually passed away this year. So in June this year, she passed away after having had, you know, a very long, fruitful, But sometimes, you know, a career that had its string of challenges, both during the Soviet period and during the period of Ukrainian independence as well.
Yeah. Now, just to give the audience maybe a little bit of a, you know, contextual kind of, I don't know, experience as to kind of the oeuvre of Kira Muratova. We actually watched a few other films of hers as well as The Ascetic Syndrome. So I saw a film called Brief Encounters and a film called Long Goodbye, which came out in the late 60s and early 70s. Now, these films are formally quite different from The Ascetic Syndrome. They're quite similar to the French New Wave. In fact, a lot of New Wave movements that were going on in Eastern European cinema at the time, such as Polish New Wave or Czech New Wave, they're all kind of vaguely based on the French New Wave.
Yeah, actually, A Brief Encounters was the first film that she directed, the first feature-length film that she directed independently. So it's a drama film that is set in a domestic environment. In fact, that's a trope of, you know, if we are to look at Kira Muratova from the point of view of auteur theory, you know, what are the kind of you know, typical features that she uses, what are the tropes, then the domestic environment, the interior, the kind of the animated interior with sort of shots that, you know, either pan across an interior or take particular fragments of it, you know, for some sort of symbolic purpose, that's very much her. So Brief Encounters is a story about, well, basically a woman and a man, about, they're married. It's sort of like a love triangle that cuts between, you know, different points in time. And it's about a female Soviet official. So it's very much about the new kind of professional woman and her estranged husband, who's a geologist and frequently goes off on expeditions. So that's sort of what the title refers to, Brief Encounters, because they only ever see each other briefly when he's at home. And it's also about a young maid who comes from the village. So it's very much, you know, there are a lot of binaries, a lot of dualities in Muratova's work, you know, sort of man, woman, the young and the old, you know, black and white versus color. And here, you know, town and country, like city and country is another thing. So The Long Goodbye, the 1971 film, that by contrast is also a kind of a family drama, but that talks about the change in, you know, the conflict of generations. And it's a story about a woman and her son, like a woman who is struggling to accept that her son is growing up and is about to fly the nest. What did you think of that one?
Yeah, I enjoyed both Brief Encounters and A Long Goodbye. I would say of the two, I probably preferred A Long Goodbye more. It felt more polished.
Yeah, it's a much more confident work, I would say.
Yeah, because one of the things that I noticed sort of formally in the way that she made those films is there was a lot of close-ups on faces and things like that, which you don't really get in The Ascetic Syndrome. It's kind of almost the complete opposite.
I don't know, you get a fair bit of that, don't you? With people sleeping and stuff like that.
Yeah, although, I mean, what I liked about both films, actually, is that the stories, if you actually put them on paper, are really, really simple, yeah, like you said. But there's so much going on and there's so much depth to the characters.
Well, one thing that has been said about Kira Muratova is that she towed that very fine line between kind of elite and accessible. So I think these films, they have different layers to them. If you choose to take them at face value, you're welcome to do that. If you want to analyze them to bits, there's a lot of fertile ground there for analysis, but it's not essential. And that's something that has a sort of feminine touch, you know? It's not over-intellectualizing. It's not overly, you know, up there in the mind. But it's very sort of true to life and kind of ironic and gentle in its complexity, if you will.
Yeah, I would agree with that for those two films. Mm-hmm. What I would say is quite interesting because obviously a huge topic in filmmaking today is obviously lack of female directors, especially in like Western filmmaking.
So this is one reason why it's probably good to at least learn the name Kira Muratova, because I think men are expected these days on dates to show their awareness of gender topics. So, you know, there aren't that many established female directors. So this is one worth knowing and name dropping.
Yeah. I also like Larissa Shepitko.
Absolutely. Another Ukrainian, Soviet Ukrainian film director. Really one of my favorites.
Yeah. So Larissa Shepitko actually directed one of my favorite films of all time, which is a the film Ascent. Called The Ascent.
Yeah.
Which is
fucking
awesome. I love myself, you know, Soviet war movies are like my favorite war movies ever.
They so come and see And The Ascent. Grim. That's another worst date movie, probably.
Yeah, that is coming up at some point. If I can find some person who's unlucky enough to want to watch it with me, yeah, either of those would definitely qualify as bad date movies.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting. Long Goodbye. Now, I find this quite fascinating because obviously I've done a whole sort of podcast where most of the episodes were about video nasty. So I'm big on the whole censorship in film thing. Now, from my perspective, my thin frame of reference, obviously video nasties, that's to do with obscenity in films. So that's the content of the films was seen to be obscene and could make people copy the actions in the film. Whereas with a film like Long Goodbye, that was banned by the authorities. It's more to do with the way the film was made or the style that the film was made in.
Well, it was actually a combination of different factors. And the interesting thing that happened was when the officials at the Odessa film studio decided to ban it, it was actually the result of a kind of prolonged debate. And there were groups of officials who defended the film and others who completely sort of tore it down. And this was all kind of infighting and kind of internal politics as much as it was about actual censorship. So the film went against the Soviet doctrine of kind of socialist realism. It wasn't seen as true to life or uplifting or didactic. It didn't seem to have any characters that particularly, you know, merited respect, and it didn't really conclude on any sort of didactic note. Like, it didn't, you know, tell you, you couldn't really draw conclusions from it, you know, easily. So that was something that that was cited. But I think it was just unlucky as much as anything. I think that Muratova struggled with small-mindedness and bad luck as much as anything else during her career. And I think the big irony of someone with such an extensive career who sort of straddled the divide between, you know, the Soviet era and the post-Soviet era was the fact that in the Soviet Union, if you were allowed to make films, money was just not a problem. You know, you had the state funding by default to do what you needed to get done. But of course, censorship was the problem, you know. But in the, you know, after the Soviet Union fell, the big problem became money. You know, where do you find money to make films that aren't going to in turn make money? You know, how do you find money to make art house films? And of course, censorship was not a problem. Suddenly, you know, it was kind of a cult of obscenity, the more the better. And the very last film of hers that she made in 2012 before retiring from cinema is called Eternal Redemption, The Casting. And it was sort of, you know, had a lot of presentiment in it. It sort of was a foreshadowing of a film. It's about a famous director, not named, who dies, leaving effectively the recordings of different castings for the main roles, just, you know, several scenes played by different actors So it's the same lines being repeated by different sets of actors again and again, until at the end we realized that this was basically the dummy run. You know, this was the casting. And the producer is trying to get a wealthy guy to sponsor the continuation of the production of this film. So it was a kind of very, you know, tongue-in-cheek, self-referential, reflexive film, which she cast some of the actors that she had already worked with in her previous films. And this idea of different people repeating the same lines, this is actually something that comes up in the aesthetic syndrome.
Yeah, that's something that happens quite a lot. Mm-hmm. Apparently in her other films as well. It's a pretty common theme. It's this absurdism where you do have characters repeating essentially the same lines over and over and over again.
Yeah, which if you think about it, like, we do that in real life, don't we? You know, a lot of what we say is liturgical, it's ritualistic. You know, quite often if you say, you know, how are you doing, again and again, and you're not waiting to hear the answer. You're just kind of acknowledging someone's presence or announcing your own presence even. So perhaps that which seems absurdist to us is actually quite an accurate reflection of some aspects of reality.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. So talking about sort of repeating lines over and over and over again, literally right at the very, very start of the film, you've got these three old women who are stood sort of in a line next to each other, and they repeat the same line. So that, I believe when I was a girl that if everyone read Tolstoy, everyone would be kind and intelligent.
Yeah. And
they don't speak it at the same time. There's like a delay because they're not saying it together, and they just repeat it about two or three different times.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there are references to Russian literature throughout, throughout her work. Obviously, this is not something that's exclusive to Muratova, but she does kind of name check Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Turgenev, in this kind of throwaway dialogue, which is what makes it interesting. You know, it's not intellectual. It's almost anti-intellectual. It's almost kind of poking fun at over-intellectualizing, putting these words in the mouths of people who aren't trying to, you know, carry any sort of torch or message across.
Yeah, which is interesting. So before we go into this in more detail, I'm going to ask you, for the benefit of the audience, to let everyone know sort of what is the story, for lack thereof, of the aesthetic syndrome. And I should point out, actually, before we start, I mean, I could give a spoiler warning, but there isn't really anything to spoil per se. It's not a film which is based on mystery or plot or anything like that. That's all kind of incidental. So basically, if you haven't seen the film already, you could probably listen to this and be all right, because it's a very dense film.
Yeah, absolutely. So The Aesthetic Syndrome was a film that was made in 1989, so at the very end of the perestroika period, just on the eve of the collapse of the Soviet Union. It wasn't released in Ukraine or Russia until 1991, so it didn't, you know, pass censorship in the Soviet Union. But it did get entered into the 40th Berlin International Film Festival, where it won the Silver Bear. So it kind of had, you know, critical acclaim at the time of its release outside the Soviet Union. And the film consists of two films. It consists of two parts. One part is in black and white, and it's sort of a harrowing portrait of one woman's grief over the loss of her husband. And it's quite, it's very formalist. It's very sort of stark. And it shows a woman who is in deep mourning. It starts actually at the funeral of her husband. And it shows a woman who goes sort of from depression into aggression back and forth, and who sort of renounces the world of the living. But towards the end is seemingly shown to sort of pick herself up pick herself back up and kind of get on with life. And it is interlinked with the second film when the film ends and we find ourselves in colour in a cinema at the premiere of this film. And the actress who plays the morning woman is actually on the stage, ready to kind of take questions from the audience. And the second story is much more, it's different in tone and in pace. That I would say is the more kind of absurdist, almost burlesque kind of descent of a school teacher who is suffering from the asthenic syndrome, which is sort of like a narcolepsy, really. It's something that makes you, it's an inflammation of the brain that makes you fall asleep at, you know, in inappropriate places. And it's basically the story of one man's mental breakdown. So the two films touch upon many of the same themes. I mean, obviously death is one. Endings, you know, the ending of one thing and the beginning of another thing. Obviously the fact that this film was made in 1989, just, you know, at the very, very twilight of the Soviet years, is significant. Because, well, basically it came out just as one regime was dying and another was beginning. So there's a lot of apprehension, there's a lot of foreshadowing, there's a lot of uncertainty. I mean, there's a lot of cruelty, but also there's some glimmer of humanity in there as well. But whereas the Soviet, you know, the official Soviet cinema was meant to be kind of very humanist and very sort of, you know, uplifting, and it was meant to tell a particular story. This film, I would say it's angry, it's misanthropic, and at the same time, it's lethargical and apathetic. What would you say?
Yeah, so my thoughts are that of the two parts, the first part is, in a way, although it's kind of supposed to be more absurdist, it's actually less absurdist than the second part. It's more linear in its structure, and it's a lot easier to follow because you're following the same character for the whole 40 minutes that it takes place. And it's, on a first watch, because I've got to be honest, I've seen this film two or three times, and the first time I saw it, it's when I was doing the 1001 films to see before you die, which is, I mean, this film is on that, is in the book, it's on that list, so I saw it for that. I got to be honest, it was a lot to take in, let's put it that way, because particularly in the second half, it doesn't really have a normal narrative structure. So even for like an art house film, it's really, really, as I say, difficult to kind of process the first time. And I think a lot of it is contextual to the Soviet Union. I think if you were someone who, you know, is from Russia now or was around, you know, in the Soviet Union at the time, there's a lot of local references and stuff that you would maybe get compared to someone like me, who's just some guy in England, you know, seeing this film like, you know, 30 years after the fact.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
I'd say that's very true. Although one thing I would say is that there's a sort of relativity to the absurdism. So what a Western audience would perceive as farce or, you know, as a kind of theatrical burlesque mise-en-scène is actually quite an accurate, you know, almost a kind of Soviet realist depiction of what Soviet life would have looked like. You know, there were even, you know, at this quite late stage in the Soviet Union, there were queues outside shops, you know, that there just weren't too many consumer goods around. Food was, you know, constantly in danger of being at a shortage. the obviously the scene at the fishmongers, you know, at the with the fish vendor outside where people are sort of scrabbling for like really disgusting looking fish and fighting over it. This would actually have been a scene in the daily life of many people, especially in provincial towns, which just didn't get, you know, a very good supply of food. So what may seem like completely crazy and an exaggeration is actually, you know, I would say as someone who, I mean, I wasn't around at that time, but was around briefly shortly after and just knowing, you know, about this stuff, it's actually quite true to life, which is what kind of makes it so, so shocking in a way, but also so valuable as a kind of portrait of the times.
Yeah, so I think it's probably worth for the audience sort of explaining. So perestroika is sort of it's the end of the Soviet Union, I guess. Is that an easy sort of overly simplified way of putting it? Yeah, so this is so Nikolai Gorbachev's sort of government.
So this is Gorbachev's period of reform. So between 1985 and 89. It's the period of sort of, let's say, liberal reform, or, you know, an attempt to give people more freedom, different freedoms, different civil freedoms. And one of them would be kind of a lessening of censorship
norms. Glasnost.
Glasnost, yeah. So greater freedom of speech. But that's not to say it was completely free, but... Mm-hmm.
Well, no, I mean... This film was the only film banned during this period as well, which is quite interesting because from what I've read up, the reason that it was apparently banned is there's a scene literally 5 minutes from the end of the film of a woman on a train swearing profusely.
Yeah.
And apparently that was the reason it was banned, although there is a lot of – there's male nudity as well.
There's female nudity, yeah.
Yes, there's nudity of both sexes, in fact, in there. But to me, from what I've read up about the film as well, there would be a lot of uncertainty at the time in the Soviet Union, because even if, well, as a Westerner, you know, decadent capitalist that I am, looking at sort of... You know, it's unease because if you're used to living a certain way for so long, even if it's bad, in inverted commas, or you're oppressed or whatever, when that is suddenly taken away from you, there is going to be this sort of confusion and things like that because you don't know what's going to happen.
That's absolutely true. And I know we said that there might be some spoilers, but that wasn't going to ruin the film for anyone. Obviously, the very last scene takes place inside the carriage of a metro train. And the main character has another episode of sleep, and he falls asleep on the very last sort of metro that's going in the depot. And the empty, dark wagon is taking the sleeping man into a dark tunnel. And of course, that sort of is symbolic of death or potential rebirth. I mean, a really weird association that I got, you know, between this scene was with V for Vendetta. Obviously,
okay.
when V is dead and he sort of, you know, sacrifices himself and sort of kills all the baddies, and then Evie puts him, you know, covers him with roses and puts him into the underground train with all the explosives that's kind of going underground towards Parliament to blow up Parliament and stuff. You remember that, don't you?
Yes, I have seen V for Vendetta, but it's been a very long time, and I was not expecting this to be brought up as a comparison to this film.
Well, it's, you know, it's this idea that this explosion, with this explosion, and obviously with the murder of the officials of the British totalitarian government, a new era begins. So this also really reminded me of you know, of the ascetic, watching the ascetic syndrome reminded me of this transition, you know, this idea that this guy lying inside the carriage of an underground train, sort of going towards oblivion, but then that oblivion signifies, you know, the end of something, but also the beginning of something else. You know, this idea of sleep being the metaphor of death and then rebirth following death and stuff like that. And obviously, you know, all the political context, because V for Vendetta is obviously a very political film inspired by 20th century history and kind of by the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century, of which the Soviet regime was one. So
it's possible then that, you know, the Wachowskis and James McTeague could have seen like the Asphenic Syndrome and thought, that's a really good idea. I'm going to steal that idea for V for Vendetta.
Well, it's not beyond, you know, the realm of the the realm of imagination. Also because actually this film is cited as being one of the few films that looks at the metro, you know, the underground. How apparently that just wasn't something that got featured a great deal in Soviet films. And this was one that like really cornered, you know, the market on that.
So what I wanted to talk about at this point is more the way the film looks. Mm-hmm. Now, the film, it's not very aesthetically pleasing, but that's deliberate, I believe.
Is it deliberate? Yeah, I think as a portrait of the times, it's sort of, it's meant to look, you know, degenerate and degraded. And it's sort of this idea of, you know, just a cup that just overflows with feeling, with disappointment, with anguish.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I mean, obviously, the sepia section of the film is obviously going to be less aesthetically pleasing. I mean, there are sections of the film that are overly lit. So it looks very white, not even really sepia, and you can't really see what's going on. All the characters in the film are not really conventionally attractive. Let's put it that way. That's a polite way of putting it, I believe, which again, I believe is a deliberate choice and things like that. Even, I mean, literally you say 2 minutes into the film where you've got the funeral procession going on of this woman, Natasha, burying her husband. It looks like it's just a gravel pit. It's not even like a proper cemetery. And you've got, before that, there's a scene with a group of men tying a can to a cat's tail.
Well, animal cruelty is something that comes up quite a lot in this film, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, and it's sort of symptomatic of the times, you know, of people being in such a state of degradation that, yeah, they're being cruel to animals.
Yeah. I mean, that was something I was going to bring up a bit later on, because there's a scene sort of near the end of the film again, which was, I found quite upsetting. But we'll come onto that in a minute. One of the things I wanted to say, I know apparently this is not meant to be a political film. At least that's Muratov's intention, but the woman's husband definitely looks like Stalin.
Yeah. It's possible that, that scene alludes to the death of Stalin, which obviously in 1953 caused a mass outpouring of grief and as such was engraved upon the Soviet collective psyche. I mean, having said that, there would have been quite a few men in the Soviet Union who had that very fashionable looking moustache. So
it's a pretty awesome tash.
It really is, yeah.
Yeah. Also, I asked you this sort of while we were watching it. One of the things that I found sort of quite interesting to think about kind of in hindsight, having watched the film a couple of times, is if the film was 2 hours and it was entirely in the same story as that opening 40 minutes. So you've got this woman, her husband's just died. She's very, very rude and violent and just lashing out at everyone and everything, you know, breaking things in our house, just behaving in this very unhinged way. but at the same time, it's very engrossing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm curious as sort of, I don't know, I was quite curious as to, what am I trying to say? I almost thought it was a shame when that part of the film ended, because I was almost curious as to what was going to happen next.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there.
Yeah, so I get, obviously, it's that's not really the point of the film. The point of the film is more the second half.
Well, the point of the film is nobody really knows what happens next.
I guess so. Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it.
I mean, I guess, you know, the sentiment is that we cannot go on like this anymore. But at the same time, what next? You know, how do we learn to live again? And that's obviously something that came later. But I think there is a symmetry to the first half, in the sense that at first the woman is in a stupor, then she's obviously very aggressive, unhinged, and destructive. She smashes up glasses and stuff. She throws clothes out of a wardrobe. But then towards the end, she sort of tidies up all the broken glass, and she puts the clothes away, and she goes outside. And when a woman says that she's got some stains on her back and tries to sort of dust her off, she doesn't kind of punch her. She lets her do it, which shows that, in fact, she is getting better.
Yeah. Yeah, like she's almost at the point of she's accepted kind mm-hmm. of what's happened. And then the second half of the film is sort of a loose series of vignettes almost
mm-hmm.
with very similar characters. One review that I saw online brought up that it reminded them, and it's quite interesting because I know you've seen this film, of Gummo
mm-hmm.
by Harmony Korine, where it's got that kind of loose, almost improvisational, absurdist feel. And it's not a linear story. I mean, this is going to sound like reductivist as all hell, but it's like a bunch of stuff is happening.
Yeah.
And it's more about kind of these people in their environment and just them living their daily lives, no matter how ridiculous or blackly comedic it might seem.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, Gummo is a little bit gross in places, isn't it? Like, it's very kind of corporeal. You see a lot of close-ups of like people chewing weird shit and stuff like that, don't you? And you get this in the aesthetic syndrome as well. You get uncomfortably close to people, you know, as they are, warts and all.
Literally. I would say what the aesthetic syndrome doesn't have is a boy sort of sticking bacon to like his bathroom wall as he's having a bath.
Well, bacon was a luxury good in the Soviet Union, so I don't think right. you know any boy was. I think a boy would be more motivated to gobble it up than he would be right. to stick it on his bathroom wall.
Wouldn't waste that bacon.
No, there's a lot of caviar eating though, just gratuitous caviar eating.
Yes. Yeah, I did notice that.
And I think that's another kind of another symbol of kind of decadence and madness. Like, I'm just gonna gobble up all the caviar.
Yeah, absolutely. Jonathan Rosenbaum, the very prominent American film critic, he absolutely loves this film. I believe it is one of his favourite films of the last sort of 30 years or so anyway. He compared this film to Fellini, which I do kind of agree with, but more in like, it's not literally the same as Fellini, but it does have a lot of the same kind of characteristics that a Fellini film would have, more in like sort of the characters, like you mentioned, it's got that kind of carnival sort of atmosphere to mm-hmm. it, where you've got the grotesques, sort of the extras, things like that.
Well, actually, that's I think that's very true, what this critic says.
Rosenbaum,
right? Because actually, Muratova's films of the kind of early post-Soviet period are also known as Muratova's Satyricon. So that's obviously a reference to Fellini. So many of her films, such as the, what is it called in English? The Tuna, is that one? Yeah.
Yeah,
The Tuna, yeah. And Two in One, and Three Stories, and The Sentimental Policeman. So a lot of these kind of early 90s and mid-90s films, they very much had that carnival film. I mean, to such an extent that one of them actually takes place in a zoo.
Right.
Yeah, so that's very, I'd say that's an astute comment. But I would say that the aesthetic syndrome, much less so, reminds me personally of Fellini.
Yeah, I would say the similarities are more kind of some of the characters and just the more the absurdism of it. And
some of them look grotesque, don't they? Like the deputy head teacher, who is quite a statuesque lady with a very shrill voice.
She does. I did mention she had a very shrill voice, but she does have a way with a trumpet.
Trumpet, yeah. She starts playing Strangers in the Night on the trumpet, which is...
Yes. Which is very weird.
Quite a moment.
Yeah, definitely. It's sort of out there.
A decadent capitalist tune, you know, seeping in through the Iron Curtain.
Yeah, and there's the Chiquita song as well, which comes up a couple of times. That almost reminded me of something like that would be in like a Woody Allen film.
Oh, why?
Because if you've watched as many Woody Allen films as I have, at the start of all his films, during the credits, he always plays like these sort of old American songs right at the start of the films. And yeah, it just sounded from that kind of period that he would probably choose. But it did work really well in this film, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
It worked very well at the ending as well, that you already mentioned.
Yeah.
So, final thoughts then, I guess, on the film. So, we've already mentioned the scene on the fish market, which I found quite threatening. Something about that was very, very uneasy. And just the overall, I guess, just the violent nature of the film. There are so many violent outbursts in the film, one of which I appreciated was a bin getting thrown through someone's window. That one stuck out to me.
Yeah, it's a very emotional film. It's a very angry film. I would say at the same like upon second viewing, this is the second time I've seen it. The first time I saw it at the cinema about 6 years ago, and I remember being absolutely floored by this film. Just leaving the cinema feeling like life was not worth living, like it was one of those. Wow. But upon second viewing, I actually see like a lot of humor emerges. I find like the violence in it, you almost kind of, you know what to expect now, and you don't become as shocked by the obscenities and the violence. And you sort of see, you know, that there's actually quite a bit of humor, quite a bit of control, and also a little bit of hope to this as well.
Yeah,
I would say this is definitely a film worth watching if you want to score kind of art house brownies and you want to look, you know, beyond the West or beyond, say, you know, Japan or Asia. This is a very good example of Soviet independent cinema that is, you know, crafted by one of the leading women film directors in the world, and I'd say, you know, and a good thing about this film is that it very much confirms our worst suspicions of what life would have been like in the Soviet Union during the perestroika years, but it does so kind of in an artful matter, you get to there's actually a lot more common ground with this. We've all felt trapped. We've all felt tired. We've all felt, you know, in some way dissatisfied with our daily lives, with the daily grind. And this film is about that as much as anything else. Not to mention the first part of the film, which talks about mourning and grief. And I would just say, like, one concluding point, that I think this is a film that shows that women can be angry and they can be misanthropic just as much as men. It's a portrait of a woman's grief and a woman's loss and aggression, as much as it is about the second protagonist's lethargy. And one thing that I found significant was there was a short scene where there was a close up of some really random newspaper magazine cutouts in a folder that some of the teachers were looking through in the staff room. And one of these was an image of the goddess Kali Ma, who is at once the Hindu goddess of creation and destruction, who cuts away all illusions. And it is a Hindu deity that kind of embodies this idea that the feminine does not have to be, gentle or soft or tender or, simply nourishing or maternal. It can also be destructive. You know, she holds within herself these two almost opposite ends of, opposite qualities. And this is what I think Muratova does. She creates something in the same way that she destroys something, within this film and within each of us as we are watching it.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. One of the things I was going to ask is, I think when you talk about a female director, I think in your mind that conjures up certain images. And one of the things that I like about this film, and indeed the film of, The Ascent by Larissa Shapitko as well, that I said, is that it's not consciously a woman's film in inverted commas. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Do you mean in the subject matter?
Just in the themes and the way that it's done and how misanthropic and violent it is, and it has nudity in it. I think one of the big misconceptions, particularly around kind of the male gaze as such, is that, if Blue is the Warmest Colour was directed by a woman, those lesbian sex scenes would be much shorter and they wouldn't be shot in a certain way, blah, 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 all that sort of stuff. Whereas just because a film is directed by a woman doesn't mean it won't have nudity in it and things like that.
Oh, sure. I think Brief Encounters and The Long Goodbye certainly had, the feminine touch. It wasn't interested in huge social or political themes or, some sort of overarching narratives. It focused on, effectively two women and their private, intimate family stories. So in that sense, I think Kira Muratova can be, she can create, women's films, but she can also turn up to 11 and come up with something completely visceral and crazy, like Asthenic Syndrome. And I think at the time people expected that that was going to be her last film. I mean, I think at the time a review came out in a Soviet magazine that's called Iskustvo Kino, The Art of Cinema. And the review was titled, the review for Asthenic Syndrome was titled, God is Dead.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's pretty awesome, I think, having that range. And
yeah.
And then, going beyond that, back into humorous, romantic, feminine films.
Yeah, interestingly, I also read online, Russian critic Andrei Dementiev declared The Aesthetic Syndrome the only masterpiece of glasnost cinema. So I don't know if that's true or not. I can't say my knowledge of glasnost cinema is as great as perhaps maybe yours is, but that's certainly high praise.
High praise indeed, and with good cause.
Yes. So at this point, we're going to do our lovely ratings as you do. So my rating for this film out of 5, I would say this is kind of like a 2-watcher. The first time I saw it was a few years ago. It was when I was doing my 1001 films to see before you die. It was very heavy going. It's a 2.5-hour long film. It's quite nihilistic and very surreal in places, and it is heavy going, but if you like your outhouse films, if you want to try something a bit different from your standard Western cinema, as Miro mentioned earlier, then yeah, I recommend it and I would give it a 4 out of 5.
Okay. Well, I chose the film, so I'm going to give it a 5 out of 5.
Okay. Well, otherwise, you would be biased.
Otherwise, yeah. I'm shooting myself in the foot here, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. 5 out of 5, definitely.
Highest possible recommendation.
Absolutely.
Okay, now this is where it gets interesting. So these are the worst date movies ever. Now, as a date movie, if we're going to rate this from 1 to 5, 1 being you can kind of Netflix and chill, and 5, you ain't Netflixing and chilling, let's put it that way. How would you rate this on the bad date movie scale?
Goodness, you know, if I could watch this with someone and they would totally get it and love it just like me and give it at least a 4 out of 5, then that's someone worth dating.
So I'm worth dating.
Awesome. I would probably say that as far as a date movie goes, it's probably not one that's going to set you in a very romantic mood. So I'd say, yeah, a 4. I'd give it a 4.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's pretty high up.
Pretty bad.
I would only give it a 3 out of 5, only because we have reviewed Cannibal Holocaust. That was a definite 5 out of 5. And even then, if you listen to the show, I actually wasn't even sure I wanted to give it the full 5 because it had artistic merit. So this is not an easy watch. It's like we mentioned, it's sort of quite bleak in a lot of ways. It's quite nihilistic. It's quite absurdist in a lot of ways. So if you're with the wrong person, they'll be just like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah. Well, it's the ultimate litmus test.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it'd be a litmus test for you, from the sounds of things, for sure.
Absolutely.
Wow, okay. I mean, for me, I mean, this wouldn't be a film that I would put on with most people. I think you're man or, well, lady, in this my case anyway, this wouldn't be very high on my list of kind of date movie watches, let's put it that way. This would be something like, if they were adventurous and they were into, like, you know, art house cinema and they had awesome taste, then yeah, it'd be something that I would kind of show them as like, look, this is kind of different and interesting and, like, you know, it's something you probably haven't seen before or haven't even heard of, you know, and I would show a bit for that reason. But for most people, because of the violence, because of the unrelenting sort of nature of the film in a lot of ways, it is pretty intense as well. And it's not horrible. It's not like gory or violent or upsetting, unless you like animals, in which case, again, you might be upset by a couple of things that happen in the film. Not like Cannibal Holocaust levels of, like, upsetting, but still, you know. So yeah, I would give it a 3.
Well,
indeed. Now, unfortunately, if you did want to buy this on DVD or indeed Blu-ray, you are shit out of luck, unfortunately, because I could not find anywhere online, any format, anywhere in the world where you can buy this on DVD. So you can't own it in physical form unless you buy some sort of dodgy DVR version of it. However, you can find it on YouTube. Although, if you are like me and you don't speak Russian, then you're kind of fucked, because the subtitles that I had to watch were okay. I kind of got the picture as to kind of what was going on, but they weren't great. So yeah, you know, if there are better subtitles out there, or indeed if you speak the lingo, you might be all right.
Yeah, well, they have been, the film has been shown before, obviously, at festivals and at universities and art house cinemas with proper English subtitles. So it's probably well worth campaigning for a proper reissue.
Yeah, I'm surprised someone like Second Run or Second Sight, whatever that company is that release all the Eastern European films, I'm surprised they haven't released this, because it's something that would be, like, right up there, you know, their alley. Mm-hmm. And, like, people would buy it, I'm sure. Like, a lot of the stuff they release is very obscure. So, I don't know. So there's possibilities for them. So, Miroslava Hartmund, I want to thank you very much for joining us. You probably have a lot of stuff to plug compared to most of the guests that I have on this show. So anything you want to let the listeners know about, please feel free.
Absolutely. Well, I'm based in Kiev in Ukraine, where you are likely to find me at the Triptych Gallery on Kiev's famous Andreevsky Uzviz, or St. Andrew's Descent. We're right opposite St. Andrew's Church on top of the hill. The street is known as the Montmartre of the East, because it's full of art, and it's a sloping cobbled street with a very beautiful church on top. And also, this is where Mikhail Bulgakov used to live and where he set his White Guard. We are open daily from 11 till 7, and we have lots of awesome exhibitions going on, both by local and international artists. And I am actually going to be in the UK very soon. I'm due to give a lecture at King's College London on Tuesday, the 4th of December, 2018, at 4:45, which is going to be on protest and cultural destruction, how the Lenin statue became a symbol for Ukraine's quest for a new identity. And I'm going to be talking about how Ukraine has dealt with its monumental heritage, so all the sort of statues and plaques and stuff, of the Soviet Union following the revolution in 2013. So join me for that if you wish. Otherwise, yeah, I can be found on www.t-gaw.com.
And you're on Twitter as well, aren't you?
Yep, Miro Hartmund on Twitter.
Awesome. So yeah, if you've enjoyed the show, yeah, please give Miro a follow. I'm sure she'll appreciate it. So just want to thank once again very much Miroslava for doing the show. Really appreciate it. It's been a long time. Glad this has finally happened.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's really been a pleasure, and thank you for being so open-minded and reviewing such out there non-Western films.
Awesome. That's the best thing to be called, open-minded. Wicked. And yeah, once again, you can hit me up on Twitter at Worst Date Movies. Thank you very much for listening to the show, and I'll catch you on the next show with more of the Worst Date Movies ever.